Hey friends, Dave Trotter here with Awaken Magazine. Before we dive into this episode, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our podcast. So if you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Amazon Music, click subscribe. Every platform's just a little bit different, but this will ensure that you get every single episode delivered right to your phone. And if you have just an extra minute, rate and review the show. That is a quick way to help us spread the word and help more people discover the incredible interviews that we release each and every week. All right, let's dive into this episode.
This is one of my favorite planets. There's a lot of planets out there, but they're not as interesting and diverse and as beautiful as this emerald blue jewel of this solar system. So why are we not living in peace? Was there ever such a world where there was war and letting people starve and horrible abuse and all those? We will be, hopefully, an evolved society. We'll have learned, hopefully, how to live together, how to take care of each other and the planet, to have compassion, love, telepathy. So that's my hope.
He was sitting in the back of an auditorium on West 73rd Street in New York when a bleach blonde housewife from Tacoma pointed straight at him from the stage and spoke in the voice of a 35,000-year-old warrior named Ramtha. In that moment, something inside Alan Steinfeld came out of his body and met that energy in the middle of the room. Reality melted, and he walked out of that auditorium knowing with a certainty that has never left him that he was something far greater than his body alone. That was 1981, and in the 40 years since, Alan has become one of the most respected voices in consciousness and UFO research. He's the host of New Realities, the author of Making Contact, and a remote viewing teacher. In this episode, Alan shares the story behind his abduction in Nebraska, why he believes the UFO phenomenon is really about human evolution, and what it means to make known the unknown. Hey, before we dive in, did you know about 50% of the people watching this video, perhaps even including you, are not subscribers and won't know about our upcoming inspiring interviews? If you want to be a part of what we're building here at Awaken Magazine, click subscribe. Click the bell to get notifications of our upcoming episodes. Hey, leave a comment telling us what you enjoyed about this conversation. That would truly help us reach more people. I'm your host, David Trotter. Welcome to the Awaken Magazine podcast. Alan, thanks so much for joining us today. It's great to be with you.
Always good to see you, David, and I love your magazine. It is really a kind of polished portrayal of the spiritual community that we have in this country.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I want to know more about you and your own awakening to consciousness, mindfulness, spirituality. And so one of the things we oftentimes start off by talking with our guests on is their childhood and how faith or spirituality was either a part or not a part of their experience. So you grew up in New York, correct?
Long Island, suburbia. Yeah.
Okay. So take us back. What kind of life did you have in terms of some connection to faith, spirituality, consciousness? Was there an experience there?
Yeah, I always thought there was a difference between faith and spirituality. I didn't even know what spirituality was. We were brought up Jewish. My father was sort of orthodox until he met my mother, and then he became quite reformed. I was bar mitzvahed, went to Hebrew school, didn't feel any connection to any spirituality there. It was just something you did. I mean, sure, there are a lot of good Jewish educations where people really learn about the spirituality, but spirituality and religion for me were two separate sort of avenues. And I'm not judging, not one better than the other. One for me was more fulfilling, but I didn't know anything about spirituality. But after my father grew up poor, he made money, you know, American dream, you know, lived in the Depression, then finally, you know, moved to the suburbs with a family of three. He started to look for spirituality. He realized that he was not satisfied just accumulating money, and he worked hard, you know, but then when he got to a certain level, he wanted something else. And so he started to study Zen Buddhism. Some of the early practices in the 70s, Eureka was one, transactional analysis. There were a bunch of emerging spiritual tradition or technologies or whatever you want to call it. So I thought that was interesting. So I even went to Zazen centers with my father as he's learned to meditate. So that was for me the doorway into, well, this is not about religion. This is about an internal process of being. I think faith is or maybe for some people it's not. I can't say what other people's practice is. For me, religion was a very exterior. It was like going to the Boy Scouts or playing. I mean, it was something external to oneself. And then when I found this level of spirituality, maybe through Buddhism and some of the other deeper psychological practices, I realized, oh, there is a spiritual component to what religion was supposed to be about. And so I didn't put that together until my father opened the door. So in a sense, my father gave me permission to really pursue what was most interesting to me, you know. So like I said, we grew up on Long Island. We had a nice family. My mother was a homemaker. My father worked hard. And when I started to look around in the world after graduating high school, then college, it's like, did I want to do the same thing? Did I want to live in the suburbs and do all that? Or did I want to seek the unknown? Did I want to make known the unknown, which is a teaching I finally came to? So if you want to know what that story is, after graduating college and studying literature, I started out with psychology. So I wanted to understand human beings. My uncle, who had just passed recently, was a psychologist, and he understood human beings. I wanted to understand how human beings thought. So I started off in college, University of Buffalo, as a psychology major. And I thought, well, that's fun. That's fun. I can learn about people and understand the world. And they didn't teach me anything about that. It was statistics. It was very boring studies. It was case studies. It was studying like abnormal minds. I mean, there was Jung, but I didn't get to Jung until later. But for me, I took one literature course, and I realized, wow, these guys and women knew more about human psychology than all the psychology manuals that I was studying. So I switched from being a psych major to a literature major, which was far more satisfying and interesting and creative and intellectual. The other stuff was just really, really boring. So literature, it's like, wow, this is not about I never really liked writing in high school, but writing from a point of view of human psychology and understanding humans, and I studied James Joyce for a year, if you know who Joyce is, that was really about the internal dialogue. It was really about consciousness, if you want to know what the source of like modern day 20th century literature was about. It was understanding of consciousness, and for me it was. And that was a far more. And so what was I going to do with a literature degree? I didn't think about that yet.
And how did your dad feel about you pursuing a literature degree?
Well, you know, my parents were pretty liberal. My mother was a little more intense about it, but my father was like, yeah, it was something he wanted to study. But instead he had to work to support his family and do all that. So he was interested in that. So my father was quite open. My mother just wanted me to like get a regular job or even go into my father's business, which eventually killed him. I didn't want to do he was in the construction business, and he liked that because he was able to be a smart business person, but it was not something I wanted to go into. So I didn't know what I was going to do with a literature degree, but I did get into film production in New York after college, and that was okay. But you know, if you're getting into production, you never end up directing. So I actually did end up directing my own short film, which I'll send you a link in. It's called Never Wear a Dead Man's Shoes, which combined my spirituality and my love of film. But after I got out of college, I was, you know, there was a kind of movement towards the New Age. In the early 80s, it was called the New Age. By the end of the 80s, it was like old age. But in the early 80s, there were these gurus around, Rajneesh. It was TM, although TM started earlier, Transcendental Meditation with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. There was Satchitananda. It was coming off the 80s were coming off the kind of post-hippie era that kind of culminated in the Woodstock Festival. Woodstock was the kind of beginning and the end, the beginning of a kind of cultural embrace, I think, of the what was a kind of underground psychedelic culture, which then became, you know, more mainstream and was sort of the end of that kind of free love 60s kind of way of being. I had just missed it. I was a little upset. I was just going to say,
were you there?
I'm a little bit post-hippie era, but it's like Don Quixote. I wish I was there in some ways, but in a way... So that was a fun, you know, the 60s was a real revolution. And I was looking at it from afar because I was not really old enough to partake in it. But it was, you know, the Beatles kicked it off and everyone loved the Beatles and they still do. You know, that's actually all I listen to is 60s music. You know, I don't know anything after 1975. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I've heard of Taylor Swift and I had no idea what her music sounds like, but... So that I was sort of part of it voyeuristically, but in the 70s and then 80s, there was a spiritual movement that sort of emerged out of that 60s kind of hippie scene. And I started to really dive into that. So the gurus were getting popular. Like I said, there were lots of Eastern influence. Ram Dass, I had met Ram Dass. That was seeping into the mainstream sort of alternative culture. And then there was this thing called channeling. Do you know what channeling is?
Oh, yes.
You do now, but in 1981, no one heard of channeling. No one even knew what the word was. So
yeah.
I had a friend that said to me, because it really, it was like, what? You mean someone else takes over your personality and you do... 1981, I had this friend from college who said, you got to see this woman. She transforms into this 35,000-year-old warrior from Atlantis, and she says these amazing things. Well, that guy was sort of a crazy guy anyway. You know, he's really out there. And I thought, this woman, whoever she is, it was probably acting. Because, I mean, not that there was a lot of money back then, but she did make a lot of money. She was acting. She was crazy. Or perhaps, maybe, possibly, I don't know, probably not. This is true.
Did you go see her?
I did see who was Ramtha the Enlightened One. Have you heard of Ramtha?
Yes. I have not studied Ramtha, but I have heard. Yes.
Ramtha is a study, yes, and it's a 20-year study for people like me and Joe Dispenza and Selma Hayek and lots of well-known. Richard Chamberlain was part of that for a while. Actors, it was big. It was a kind of the emerging new age phenomena before its time in the early 80s, like Jay-Z started channeling, Jay-Z Nye, who was channeling around, started in 1979. I met them in her, it, both of them in 1981. So I didn't really know what to think about it. I was just going to kind of satisfy my friend who was kind of saying, you got to go. And it's like, maybe there's something here. So it's in New York City. I mean, Jay-Z Knight, who would, I think she still channels, but she would tour around the country, you know, doing different cities with what was called the dialogues. People asked this being who she called Ramtha, 35,000-year-old warrior from Atlantis, questions. So I was there in the audience and thought it was vaguely entertaining, you know, and interesting. People asking ridiculous questions about their pets or their relationships, which is, it's all fine. But then So Jay-Z is a bleach blonde housewife from Tacoma, Washington. She actually is a full-on trans channel, or was back then. And her body sort of swells up. Her eyes go from blue to totally dilated pupils, black. And she marches around the stage like a warrior. And she is gone. You don't get many full trans channels. Even Bashar is a trans channel, but he's still around. She is out of it. She goes to the light. She basically dies and goes to the light. And when she channels, she has missed years of her life channeling Ramtha. But anyway,
how would you find that mildly entertaining? Or would you not find at that point in your life, like, whoa, either this lady's crazy or she's onto something?
Yeah, that's why I went there. She's onto something. Yeah, it's entertaining, but the questions people were asking were not entertaining.
Okay, gotcha.
So, I mean, of course, Ramtha would go into like the history of Atlanta. I mean, there was a lot of interesting things as I got deeper into those teachings. But that day in October on West 73rd Street off of Central Park West in this auditorium was kind of okay. But then Ramtha turns to me. I'm sitting in the back of the room and he's marching around the stage, he, she, them. Are marching around the stage, and he points to me and says, "What say you, beloved entity? How be you this day in your time?" And I said, "What? What was that?" I said, "Are you talking to me?" Because it's like this is like a Shakespearean voice, which appealed to my literary kind of interests, which made it a little more interesting. I said, "Are you talking to me?" He goes, "Indeed, beloved entity, you be a most contented being." And I said, "Well, okay, thank you very much." And then what happened? This is the moment, David. This is the moment you're looking for, the inciting incident. So I'm there in the back of the room, not sure if he's really talking to me or not. And then Ramtha's up on the stage. And there was a moment where the reality just sort of melted. Like things got a little misty and fuzzy. And it's like, I felt this part of me kind of come out of me and meet this energy of Ramtha. We sort of like embraced in the middle of the room energetically. I didn't even know that was possible. And I knew at that moment I was greater than my body, that who I was something more than anything I had learned, especially in psychology or any religion or anything, that this essence was an immortal essence. And it was activated in that presence. And that was a door to everything I would do for the next, 40 years after. So, I just thought, well, maybe this is just a strange incident. I'm going to look at some literature like this. I read Autobiography of Yogi. I figured if this was a real event, there'd be some depth to it. If there was nothing to it, it'd just be like kind of superficial. And then just, okay. So I started to read some spiritual literature, and then I realized how deep it really was. And it's like, once that door opens, you really can't go back. Like there's no, once the door to those spiritual understandings awaken something deeper. And so that was it. The door opened, and that's been my pursuit for
40 years. Amazing.
At least. And you know what? That is all that I've done. You know, I didn't need a house in the suburbs for all the things I had just grown up with. I was mostly passionate, interested in who are the spiritual teachers of our time? Where can I learn more? Where can I understand this greater essence of myself? Where can I have greater awakenings? And, you know, I became a seeker. Of course, the old saying, there's a seeker born every minute. But no, I became a seeker and a finder. I have to say there are seekers and there are finders. I mean, I found some great teachers, great wisdom, I mean, great understandings about the nature of reality. I was with Ramtha for like 20 years. I was in that kind of, I would say organization. Some people called it a cult. I wouldn't call it a cult because there was no one telling you had to do that. So it was a teaching. I would call that a teaching. And that was the kind of became the foundation for a spiritual understanding that I still have today. And like I said, Joe Dispenza started there. He got all his early training there. A lot of people did. And I understood the what I would call the nature of reality, or why incarnation, and what the difference between soul and spirit is, and who we are really, and what's why did we incarnate on this planet, and what's the purpose of our mission and destiny here. So those things started to make sense to me. I mean, do you know the difference between soul and spirit? I mean, a lot of people
Tell me more.
Well, maybe then you don't know. The spirit is the fractal of the all-wise knowing intelligence creation. It's what each one of us are essentially and forever are, and we are fractal of the source. And but the soul, so as we kind of split from the first level of reality, the wholeness, the essence of all that is split into the fractals of all these different beings on all these different dimensions and planes of existence, we started to create levels of manifestation, let's say. But we had these experiences, but there is no way to get the wisdom of those experiences if there was no container to hold that wisdom. Some people call that the Akashic Records. I just call it the soul. And so the soul is created as a child of the spirit to hold the wisdom of experience. So every experience you have is recorded on your soul, Akashic Record, as a memory and learning of and an emotional kind of vibration of each moment of your life, each incarnation, each parallel dimension. It's on the soul level. So the soul, in a sense, is a child of the spirit, so the Lord. What Ramtha called the Lord of your being, the God of your being is the spirit, the Lord of your being, which is the feeling sense, is the soul. What they say, what is joy, what's sad to the soul is joy to the spirit, because the spirit just wants to have adventures. The soul registers those adventures as wisdom, you know, and sometimes it takes a couple of those experiences to gain the wisdom of that particular adventure. The idea is we're here to be in the field of incarnation, to understand and to have every human experience that you can possibly have. And then we own the human experience, and that starts to ignite the frequencies of ascension in our body. So when you can look at everyone and say, doesn't mean you've have to done everything, but you've had to have the emotional experience. This is how I interpret it. This is just my definition. If you have the emotional understanding of every human emotion, and you can look at everyone and say, I've been that, I know what they feel like, that is the wisdom of the human incarnation. And when you can fulfill that destiny, which is why we've come here, among other things I'll get to, then your cellular structure starts to ignite into an ascension process. That's how I understand it. So ascension really is a product of a life well-lived, full of compassion, full of understanding, is the owning of the human experience. And then the vibratory rate of your cellular structures take on a new energetic form, and you ascend, which was what Ramtha said he did, into the next plane of dimensional reality. You know, that's one reason we're here. We're also here to be the creators, to create new possibilities, to make known the unknown, to create something that has not existed before, like you're doing with your magazine. You've created something. It's a very creative process, and you're doing and adding to the wisdom of experience by doing what you're doing as a creator. You're adding to other people's creation. So one of the things that Ramtha talked about was making known the unknown, which is what creativity is. You're taking access to this force of chi or energy that's flowing through us, and you're manifesting that in the world so other people can have that experience, like making music or song or writing or books. These are ways of sharing our creativity to add to creation, to further the human experience, and making known the unknown, evolving all collective awareness to the greater level of awakening.
Speaking of books, I happen to have one in my hand.
Yes.
A signed copy I will share with our listeners. Mm-hmm. Making Contact, Preparing for the New Realities of Extraterrestrial Existence. Mm-hmm. Making Known the Unknown, as you just said. I'm curious, when did you become aware of or curious about, there's all sorts of words, right? ETs, mm-hmm. UAPs, UFOs, contact. Mm-hmm. When did that come into your consciousness?
Well, that is a great question. You know, I just want to say one thing about the UFO phenomenon in general. This is the challenge that humanity is now meeting. And of course, it's been going on for a long time, to go to the next level. We have to expand our awareness if we're really going to meet these beings, whoever they are, on an even playing field without going to fear or worship or any of those things, because they are a higher reflection of us, and they're pulling us up to the level where we can finally be a planetary race that lives in coherence. So when I was younger, I think really just like even 3 or 4 years old, I used to see these strange faces in the window. I was a little freaked out by that. I didn't know what to make of that. I felt actually I was really different than the rest of my family and the rest of the people I knew. I mean, I think there's one in every family. That's so I never felt like I quite fit into this structure of socialization. You know, I didn't like team sports. I rather had individual sports. I don't know. I just felt like I knew there was more to reality. So my big transformation, though, into the UFO phenomenon. I used to be obsessed with Star Trek in the 70s. I love science fiction. If you read my chapter, the whole experience about science fiction for me was this doorway into this other level of consciousness, because they were the real avant-garde writers of our time. I mean, so, you know, living on other planets, moving your consciousness into a robot body, that I read about like in elementary school. I thought that parallel timelines, parallel dimensions, things that people are talking about now are all in the old Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, all these great science fiction, right? Philip K. Dick, all these people experimented with consciousness in a way that now would be considered spiritual, but it's also science fiction, but maybe it's also science reality now, you know, what they're learning about consciousness, telepathy, all that. But getting back to your question, so I had this very interesting sort of obsession with science fiction. I wanted to be an astronaut. That was big when I was growing up. I thought, well, I do want that, but in a different way. I had some strange dreams. I definitely had some out-of-body experiences when I was younger. But in 1987, do you remember 1987?
I do. I was 14 years old.
Right. There was something called the harmonic convergence. You might not remember that.
I do not remember that. I was playing baseball or basketball or something.
The harmonic convergence was the first New Age spiritual holiday. It was going to be August 16th and 17th in 1987. Jose Arguelles, if you know who he had translated the Mayan calendar. And he said that August date would be the end of the ninth hell. The nine hells started when Cortez invaded Mexico in 1519, and there'd be nine cycles of 52 years that would be like the human experience of hell. And in 1987, it would be the last 25 years. And in 2012, we'd have a whole new calendar. That was where the 2012 myth sort of started with Jose Iglesias. But it was a forerunner to end this ninth hell in 1987. It was going to be a big celebration worldwide. So, you know, since I was already kind of hooked into that kind of new age scene by looking at, you know, gurus and channels and all that in the 80s, we were all ready for this time. It was a great celebration. People were celebrating in Machu Picchu and in Sedona and Mount Shasta. I mean, around the world. This is before the internet.
Where were you?
I drove around the country in a van that I had to check out really where I wanted to be. I wanted to see what was the best place. So in July, before August, I kind of took a road trip in a van that I bought from working in the film industry. And it was kind of nice sleeping van. And I came to Sedona, not for the first time, but it was sort of like, I had been there briefly before, but Sedona, I wanted to experience, okay, is this the place where I really want to be? Because it was going to be. And I happened to meet this woman there. It's very beautiful, very kind, nice woman there. And actually, we end up traveling together. Yes, we traveled together. We went up to Oregon, checked out the Oregon Country Fair, and then we were heading Then we were heading back east. She was living outside of Detroit. I was going to go back to New York because there was a wedding I was going to go to, and then I decided where I was going to be. Anyway, we're heading back east from Oregon, from the country fair. We just stopped at the Cougar Hot Springs outside of Springfield, Oregon. Do you know the hot springs out there?
I'm not aware of the Cougar Hot Springs.
Oh, you got to go there. It's probably the nicest hot springs on the planet. I'm sure some people know that. And actually, I wanted to clear up my lungs because the country fair is a very dusty event. Have you ever been to the Oregon Country Fair?
I have not been to the Oregon Country Fair, no.
That was the forerunner of like Burning Man, I would say, anyway, we stop there and then we keep driving east on 80 because, you know, 80 goes right across the country. And we pull off the side of the road in western Nebraska. I think it's North Platte, Nebraska. And we're just really, really tired. And we just kind of pull off the side road into a dirt road. And we just kind of pass out. We just kind of fall asleep. You know, after driving we're driving cross country. It's a long trip.
Mm-hmm. A lot of hours.
We wake up in the morning as if we've been frozen in place or suspended animation all night. And who even remembers how you went to sleep? I mean, we woke up, we both realized we woke up in the same position we had fallen asleep. And that was kind of creepy. And the place itself was a little weird. And so we just wanted to get out of there. But I ended up realizing I had this mark on the back of my leg, this four-prong puncture mark on the back of my knee. And I said, must be a spider bite or something. And anyway, we continued on. We were even more connected after whatever happened to us than before. We had this like really high energy physical connection after that. It was really kind of intense. And I get back to New York and, you know, I have this wedding with the family. And I happened to run into some of Bud Hopkins' people. You know who Bud Hopkins is?
I don't know. Tell me.
Bud Hopkins was one of the earliest abduction contactee researchers. He's the one that turned John Mack onto the whole UFO thing. He turned Whitley Strieber on. He used to have meetings. Anyway, I asked one of his people, do you know what this mark is on the back? And they said, yes, that's an abduction mark. I said, what? So I couldn't deny the fact that something had happened, and it definitely wasn't a spider bite, but that realization that maybe we were contacted or something pulled me down the rabbit hole for good. you know, became it became two things. It became an obsession and a kind of freaked out thing. What? I mean, I don't remember this. It happened to me. And it's like, so I started to read every single book and meet every person in the field of ufology who've been studying this, because I wanted to know what happened. I wanted to know the mystery of this phenomena. And you know, when was that? In 87? Almost 40 years later, no one has given me a satisfactory answer. Nobody. And that's why this book, if you look at the back of it, it's a collection of writing by the people I consider the most knowledgeable in the business.
Yes.
You see who's on the back there? Can you
of
read
course. Those names? Yeah. Linda Moulton Howe, Whitley Strieber, John Mack, Daryl Anka, Nick Pope, Grant, rest in peace, Grant Cameron, J.J. and Desiree Hertog, Carolyn Corey, Mary Rodwell, Henrietta right. Weeks.
These people, except Henrietta, are all well-known ufologists, and they became, if you go to enough conferences, David, as you know, you start to hang out with people, they become your friends, you go out to dinner with them, you know, you start to know them. So when I went to a publisher and said, oh yeah, I want to write a book on UFOs, I have this outline, he said, well, yeah, why don't you talk to all the people you know, get them to write a chapter and see what, and do an overview of the phenomena. That was what we decided would be. And there really isn't a book like this, is talking to people I consider the best in the field, the most knowledgeable. All those people, Nick Pope became a good friend too. I know he just passed, and I was really sad about that because he kicks off that book. He's a government insider, and his first line, he said to me, is this okay to write? He says, every book has to have a villain. And so he called himself the villain because he's the one with the secrets. He's the one that is still, I think he took those secrets to his grave, because I would ask him, Nick, what did you learn at the Ministry of Defense that you've been sworn to? And he said, I can't tell you. I asked him that a couple of times. I asked him that at a public forum at Contact in the Desert. So that's real integrity, whatever it is. I mean, he's keeping a secret, but that. So I wanted to get as broad a view of the phenomena as possible, to going from people like Nick Pope to the, which is, he's a real nuts and bolts guy. I mean, it's kind of had some, spiritual moments, but I think he really focused on the nuts and bolts, why we need secrecy, why we need technology, all that. So that's the exterior. And I move, this is my literary background. I move from the exo consciousness to the esoteric, the exterior to the interior. And then I end up with a chapter with Carolyn Corey and Mary Rodwell. And Daryl Anka wrote a chapter there about his relationship with this extraterrestrial, Bashar. So I try to incorporate the whole view of the phenomenon, because like I said, nobody really knows what's going on. The Hertogs put a really good chapter in there about the spiritual dimensions and the extra celestials, not just the extraterrestrials. So, but anyway, that book is like the different parts of the elephant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to connect our earlier conversation to what you're talking about now, because you talked about that faith felt more external for you, right? It was the things out there. And as someone who grew up in a conservative evangelical home, and I was a pastor for 10 years, a great deal of that felt external, very performative, very right, wrong, good, or bad. It was more about ethics and behavior and doing the right thing versus what's transformative on the inside, although we talked a lot about it. And then you talked about spirituality being more this internal world. And so now you're kind of relating that to the ET world, that there is an external component and then an internal component. So I'm curious about even the word contact that you use here. How much of contact do you think of as being out there, you know, that is then we're having some sort of face-to-face, you know, hand-to-hand contact versus some sort of internal, more of an experience of human consciousness with these beings who maybe cannot be seen? How much of it is out there versus in here?
I have to first tell you, David, very, very intelligent insight and question, and you're absolutely right. In order to cover the whole phenomena, You have to understand the nuts and bolts, but also understand that making contact is making contact with ourselves, who we are as eternal beings, who we are as evolving consciousness in a cosmos that's full of consciousness, and understanding the nature of a broader physical reality. So I'm saying you have to have a foot in both worlds. You need to have your feet on the earth and your head to the sky, basically.
Head in the clouds.
So the phenomenon itself is divided into those two separate camps, I have to say. There's the Department of Defense, there's the defense, the offense. The defense is the government saying, no, we can't tell you what we know. We're trying to develop weapons. And the offense, in a sense, is the phenomenon itself. They're coming and they're going and they're interacting with people, not just on a nuts and bolts level. People's consciousness are being affected by the phenomena. They're being upgraded. They're having visions. These beings come in their dreams. Their neurology shifts. Their creativity shifts. So there's an internal component to that. Depends on what type of person you are that you look at the phenomenon. I'm looking at as external. Yeah, that's a UFO. Or, wow, that did something to me when I saw that thing in the sky, and I feel like my thoughts are evolving. They're not thinking the same way. You know, if you're living in a very small reality and something so extreme comes around, it can be shocking, ontologically shocking, or a cognitive dissonant moment. But all that is about waking people up to the broader phenomena about who we are. So that's ultimately, I go with the spiritual part of the phenomena as an evolutionary moment in human history. John Mack, who I asked you, who did you know who he was? He was a psychiatrist at Harvard.
Prior to your book.
Yeah. So he started to talk to contactees. He was like a not so mainstream, but he was a really traditional psychiatrist. He knew what insanity was. He said, these people are not crazy. They are having a real experience. And so he started to look at what's going on, and he realized it was about consciousness. And he says, my favorite quote of John Mack, and I knew him. He was, I wouldn't say he was a friend, but I mean, he was very friendly. I mean, I would see him at conferences. He said, UFOs are like an outreach program from the cosmos for the consciously impaired. That's us. We are the consciously impaired. So I love that quote of John. And he also said, we need other ways of thinking if we're really going to understand the phenomenon. We cannot understand this with our logical, rational, materialistic Western view of reality. Something else is happening there. So the conclusion, in a way, to your question is that this phenomenon is asking us to change from our materialist living on the surface of things, flatland, Ken Wilber would call it, into realizing there's a depth, there's a meaning, there's a purpose to reality. If you just look at Darwinian theory, it's all an accident, we shouldn't be here, life is a freak of nature. Or the other side is, are we living in a living universe? Darwinian, you know, the Darwinian, I would say Newtonian physics would say the universe is dead. It's a machine. It doesn't mean anything, even though Newton himself was a metaphysician. But mostly the Western worldview is that we're living in a dead universe, a lifeless universe. And I think the change that's coming is we are living in a universe full of life, consciousness, possibility, and expansion of the perceptual nature of reality. That's mm-hmm. what the UFO phenomenon really represents to me. Because like Jacques Vallée said, if we just are meeting visitors from another planet, I'd be like alien tourists checking out Earth. I'd be very disappointed, was what Jacques Vallée said. Mm-hmm. No, there's something else going on in the phenomena, which I go into, but I start with the exterior. And then I go deeper into, this is about a systemic change in who we are as human beings. Homo universalis. We are humans of the universe. We are where it's a, it, in a sense, it's a spiritual understanding because we're realizing how much more we are. What began in the 1980s as a new age and human potential is now coming into realizing that we are these infinite beings. We are consciousness itself is infinite, which gets me into why I'm so passionate about teaching remote viewing. Do you know that part?
Tell me more. I mean, I know what remote viewing is, and I know that you're involved in it. And I've got questions here, Alan. I have questions to ask you.
Okay. ask me I can go on and on, but ask me. Go ahead. Ask me anything.
No, go ahead. You're passionate about remote viewing. I want to hear why.
No, just say it. Remote viewing is just is obvious proof that we're not limited to this physical body, that our minds, our consciousness extends beyond space and time. And I can get more into that. But yeah, ask me whatever you have.
Well, I'm curious about, you're talking about this experience with contact, that it can be external, but there's also an internal reality to it. Same thing connected to spirituality. There's an internal experience. How does one differentiate between what is quote unquote real, what is just some sort of elevated perception, what is pure imagination, and what is, psychosis? Especially, how does one differentiate that for oneself? But then how do we, and do we need to differentiate that for others? There are individuals who I watch online that I'm like, I don't know, this seems a little off, you know? Like, how do you differentiate that?
That is a really, really excellent question. And that's really the question most spiritual people have to ask. Well, is this person crazy? Everyone has a red line, you know? I mean, in a sense, there's things people tell me. It's like, I'm out there, but I'm not that out there, you know? I'm not.
You know, one of the reasons why I ask this question is because coming from an evangelical Christian world, which I have long, transitioned out of. I left being a pastor in 2008 and went through my own deconstruction process. There's a very clear box. Here is the box of theology. And it is clear. If it's not all about Jesus, Holy Spirit, God, and this interpretation of the scripture, it is satanic. It is demonic, you know, right? And so then as I'm coming in the last, let's just say six years of spirituality, one of the first things that I was very clear to notice was, whoa, there are no boundaries here at all. Zero boundaries. And yet,
that's unfortunate. Yes.
Yet, is there a question of there is light and dark, right? Because if there is no, I would hate to say good and evil, but yet high vibration, low vibration, helpful, unhelpful, healthy, unhealthy, like how does one differentiate between all of those things?
No, that is the question of the day. That is the question of the spiritual culture that each of us have to really understand or decide for ourselves. I mean, I think you could say there's light or dark, or you could say darkness is just the absence of the light, for instance.
Sure.
There are things I don't believe. I mean, people sell me a lot of way out stuff and it's like, okay, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you. You know, it's like that. So
give me one that you've heard recently where it was just like out there. Obviously, don't tell us who it was, but like something
Tell you the ones that really turn me off. The 20 and back stuff is just like, you know what that is? These people, and there's like a bunch of them. And this is like where I really roll my eyes. I'm sure people roll their eyes at me when I said, yeah, I've had contact with aliens. So it's like levels and levels. So there's people who claim to be, have gone to Mars through a kind of a wormhole thing that was located in some office building, and suddenly they're on Mars and they're there for 20. I mean, this is insane for me to even.
A physical reality experience.
So they say. They go to Mars, they do whatever they do on Mars for like the secret US government, and then they come back and they're 20 years later, but they're reversed back to when they left at 20 years old. I mean, I don't even want to give that energy.
You just did.
I did because you asked me, but I don't. think that is a credible.
Sure,
and
sure.
You know, those stories are, I feel like the whole flat earth thing are psyops implants to make the whole field look really crazy.
So
there are people talking about flat earth, don't you see? And they believe it because somebody fed them some ridiculous thing. So you need discernment. Discernment. And I've met crazies in this field who were, I mean, there's one guy I know from New York, he's always looking up at the sky and they say they're looking at me, they're talking to me. There are crazies in every business, according to my judgment. This is pure judgment. And I feel like if I'm not getting truth, if I'm not feeling they're giving me information I can use, I don't need to hear it, and I don't need, you know, if it's just, I get a sense of their own ego. I mean, I'm very judgmental of channels. I mean, there's a lot of people channeling out there, and most of them are, in my opinion, because I think I've seen the best going back to the 80s. Most of them aren't channeling anything except their alter ego, in my opinion. I mean, they may be saying great things, but if I'm not getting.
How would you determine that?
What can I learn something new from this person? Or are they giving me the information in a feeling vibration in something that is expanding me? And so it's a feeling, it's a kind of intellectual understanding, it's a energetic thing. But getting back to the UFO stuff, because there is some really out there things like, you know, the Mars jumping program. And I said to one guy, well, what are you doing on Mars? And he goes, well, we're selling beer to the rest of the solar system. I said, well, okay, I really got to go. Thanks for your information. It's like, I mean,
He's not going to be in your next book.
No, I don't have the patience for something that isn't intelligently designed, I would say. Mm-hmm. So that's my own private discernment sort of thing. I mean, there's a lot of fundamentalists like in the UFO world, like there is in, you know, theology and any world. So I like the people who have a wider view of reality, people that are in that book, even though mm-hmm. Nick Pope was a very kind of government person, he was open. He was expansive. I mean, everyone I asked to write a chapter, and John Mack, I didn't ask him to write because he was already gone, but I talked to his archivist and I said, well, there's this chapter, this talk that John gave, and I wonder if can I publish in my book because it sounds very contemporary. And, you know, read that chapter by John because he is very level-headed. He talked to a lot of people and he said, you know, he comes from a psychiatric background. So Harvard, he was a teacher of psychiatry at Harvard, and Harvard said, you can't say at Harvard that people are having ET experiences. And he goes, well, he had to decide, are these people experiencing psychosis or are they indeed having a real experience? And by using his background in psychiatry, he said, for the most part, except for these experiences, these people are normal, functional, productive, highly motivated people. You know, people who are, I mean, there's signs of psychosis and, you know, people very, in a way, self-obsessed, self-indulgent, delusional, you know. I mean, we're all a little delusional maybe, but, you know, without any self-awareness, I find the people that, I mean, I'm not even sitting back and judging my own thoughts. I mean, we have to have critical thinking of whatever we believe ourselves. Just like, you know, there's people who take fundamentalism very seriously. You're going to burn in hell. And they think that is really hell they're going to burn in. And that's okay. They can believe whatever they want. And then there's people taking the words of Jesus and say, wow, this is a real model for living. It's a real metaphor for a higher spiritual life. You know, you don't come to me except through the through that who had sent me, which is the God self I am in all of us, you know. So there's, you can take the words of Jesus based on your background and use it very, very in a small way, or you can expand and see, well, how can I use these words to expand what I know of myself and my own spirit? So in the UFO phenomena, I see how critically open are people to their own beliefs, because belief doesn't mean it. Belief is conjecture. You could believe whatever you want. Belief is make-believe. So I say that. So you could believe a lot of things, but do you know it? Do you take it seriously? Or are you critical of your own belief system, which I hopefully am? I mean, I think there are abductions contactees. I mean, I think I've had that, but do I know it? Well, it didn't happen in this reality, so I'm still questioning everything I know. What I do know is that there's something here for sure. There's a phenomena interacting with human consciousness and the world, and they're hidden, and they're here, and they're gone. And, you know, the best way of explaining this, getting away from your question, was something somebody said about Einstein's work. Something unknown is doing we don't know what. That's what I say about the UFO phenomena. Something unknown is doing we don't know what. What that thing, maybe the government knows a little more. I think they do. But they are trying to put it into a box. They're trying to make people afraid. The defense, oh, no, we can't reveal that for national security secret. Well, that's all another level of the lie. They're taking it literally. It's like they're not seeing the bigger phenomena. So they're looking at this object's how to create weapons. You know, but most people, experiencers, people have had interaction with these beings, at least I have on a dream level. I think it was in a dream, because these are dreams you don't forget if you've interacted with these other beings somehow. Most dreams, they kind of fade away, and these have stayed with me actually since that time in 87, some of them. But if you're looking at the Defense Department, see, be afraid of what you don't know. It's like, you know, children and go for what they don't know. And those who are really say, no, stay away from what the unknown. So do you embrace the unknown or do you fear the unknown? Well, the unknown is only, if you fear it, you're only projecting the known onto the unknown, because the real unknown is full of possibilities, wonder, and unexpected treasures. That's what I say, the unknown. So do you make known the unknown, or do you hide in your little cave saying, no, don't go there because it might be dangerous? And maybe, but I think I see more positive effects of the phenomena than negative effects. So anyway, back to another question. Yes.
2027. Mm-hmm. Daryl wears this on the front of his shirt wherever he goes, Daryl Anka.
Yeah.
And underneath it, it says, I don't have it in front of me. What does it say underneath?
The year that changed everything.
The year that changed everything. Okay. Do you believe that that's true? And if so, what do you think is going to change?
Well, you asked me if I believe it's true. And I just said belief is conjecture. It's not, doesn't mean anything. So do I believe it's true? I think something seems to be building inside the government, inside the world politic. I mean, we're in a dangerous time with some intense things happening just geopolitically. I think the planet is building towards a very exciting moment. If you ever read Shakespeare, Act Four is where everything changes. You know, Act Four, right before it resolves in Act Five, we're in Act Four of the human drama here. And which way will it go? Will it be a comedy or a tragedy? You know, I think it feels, for me, my feeling is that we're building towards a huge shift of something. I think there are people, and I've studied this, more people around the planet having experiences, having contacts, having sightings. I was just out in Sedona with a bunch of people, and there were these lights coming up over the horizon. They come up, they were yellow-like lights. They weren't flashing or playing, and then they fade away. And about 20 of them saw that. There's my friend Peter Sterling, who had a video that went viral recently with all these lights. He was out there. We were with him. We're seeing these things. So I've seen other stuff in the sky. I've seen blue beams coming out of lights. I saw this I was in Sedona with night vision goggles. Night vision goggles amplify the light like 10,000 times. So someone said, look, there's a triangle up there. And I looked through the night vision and there was this triangle like this. And as I was looking at it, went from pointing up to point, it went like that. You know, so how does it know that maybe it doesn't, maybe it was just a coincidence, but David, there is something going on and it's getting closer and maybe, perhaps, who knows, 2027.
So what if nothing happens? What if nothing happens in 2027 and Daryl has risk, you know, is he risking his
reputation? Yes.
Reputation on this?
Well, he's risked it before and he's actually, you know, well, you know. no, you know, prophecy, you know, there's a whole book out, when prophecy fails, people become more of a believer, but, there's people always making predictions, you know, it's all based on the moment of now. Even if you ask Bashar, anything he sees for the future is based on the probability of as it's seen in this moment.
Sure. And we can have impact on what ends up unfolding a year from now.
And we can also change what's happening. Yes, exactly. And exactly. So I don't know. And who cares? We'll see what happens. You know, I'm excited because every year we're getting closer to truth and something's going to happen. Something's about to give way. Because if we don't, we're in a lot of trouble. I'm not saying they're here to rescue us, because they're definitely not here to save us from ourselves. We have to really wake up and take responsibility for being, you know, conscious being with each other. We are on one planet. This is what those astronauts just coming back from being around the moon said. This is one of my favorite planets. I'll tell you that right now, David. There's a lot of planets out there, but they're not as interesting and diverse and as beautiful as this emerald blue jewel of this solar system. So why are we not living in peace? You know, one of my favorite quotes, it's very touching, is that H.G. Wells, who wrote the first book about alien invasions, War of the Worlds, at the end of his life, he said, maybe someday people will look back at old newspapers or magazines and think, was there ever such a world? Was there ever such a world? Where there was war and letting people starve and horrible abuse and all those. And in the future, as I see it, we will be hopefully an evolved society. So it doesn't matter if the ETs come or not, because we'll have learned hopefully how to live together, how to take care of each other and the planet, how to realize the God essence inside of us, how to activate the human potential of our universal mind, to have compassion, love, telepathy, all these vital, what maybe you would call gifts of the spirit embodied in the human being of this next decade to come. So that's my hope.
Thank you so much, Alan. Yeah, that's beautiful. You've recently created a song called Impossible Things, which if you're watching this or listening to this, we will actually embed the Spotify playlist or Spotify player in the text version of this interview on awakenmagazine.com. But Impossible Things, tell us, what is your vision of this song?
Well, I've been doing lots of workshops, which I've been doing since the 80s, since I met Ramtha in 1981, I keep doing workshops. But I recently did a workshop of mindsight seen through blindfolds, telekinesis, psychic awareness, remote viewing, learning out of body travel. These are things considered impossible by the mainstream world. The fact that consciousness exists without the body. I mean, how do you explain near-death experience? How do you explain out-of-body travel, astral projection, all these things? So I looked at those things that I've been studying, which is very foreign to a lot of the mainstream world. They would call it impossible. You can't see something that's not to your immediate senses. Well, remote viewing shows you, and I prove it in my own class, and the CIA and Stanford Research Institute proved it 50 years ago in the 70s that you can remote view. Things don't have to, consciousness is non-local and you can perceive it. I just went to Russell Targ's birthday party. He was a founder, and he's very proud of the fact that now there are probably 10 million websites using the word remote viewing that started as a catchphrase in the 1970s. So these are impossible by the old paradigm. So I put all these impossible things, consciousness floating beyond the brain and the body. That's how I started off. And I based it. So I was thinking, I want to talk about these impossible things. So what's a good sort of melody? So I thought of Julie Andrews' song from Sound of Music. These are some of my favorite thing. You know, when your dog bites, when you're feeling bad, just think of some of my, I think, favorite things, and then you won't feel so bad. So I wanted to create that melody because I was naming all these things, but I couldn't really find it. So I found, someone told me about this incredible AI app called Suno, which writes your music. You give it the words, you pick a genre, and I wanted to sort of sound like Julianne, but they really didn't have that. So I picked the big band sound of the 1930s and 40s. I put my words about all these different impossible things that we are now, as human, potentially evolved: remote healing, you know, remote sensing, energy, Reiki, all those things that I've studied for the last 40 years into that song, put this big band melody to it. Got a voice like Frank Sinatra, who my parents loved. I mean, it was a little before my time, but it comes off great. And what was so great about Frank Sinatra, I mean, most people under 30 never even heard of Frank Sinatra, you know that. But he was a great phraser of words. I mean, you understood everything. That's what one of the things he's known for. So he was the first superstar, a little aside about Frank Sinatra. But anyway, I put this Frank Sinatra voice to my words about impossible things. And it just came out magically. I could not have gotten musicians to do it better than what this Suno AI app music thing did. And really, like, I could listen to that song all day. Even though I wrote it, it reminds me of who we really are. We are fantastic beings that never been recognized in the old paradigms. And when we realize that what we thought were impossible is now possible, that's a paradigm shift. And we're like Awaken magazine. What are people awakening to, David? Their own infinite nature. That's why you're doing it. You're telling people who they really are, which I'm really happy and happy to know you and happy you're doing this. And you're talking about impossible things. What are you talking about? This is what my mother would say, who was not very, what are you talking about? Awakening, stop it. Just do your homework or something.
A job.
Yeah, get a job, exactly. Although now that she's passed over, I think she has a different point of view. I feel
that. Yes. Alan, tell us, where can people find you out and about at events coming up in the next, through the end of 2026?
Thank you. Well, I have my website, newrealities.com. So I package everything I do in the frame of new realities, because this is what I'm pursuing. All the people I've interviewed have talked about this next level of reality, which is a mind expansion. So my website, newrealities.com. I have my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/newrealities, where I interview a lot of the cutting edge impossible thinkers, people who are really pushing the envelope of what is possible. I'm doing an event. I'm doing the Psy Games, which is a friendly competition of psychic activity in Charlottesville. Look up Psy Games International. I'm doing the Contact in the Desert, which is like, you know, I have not missed one. It's been 14 years. Because I'm still obsessed with the UFO phenomena. Actually, I dedicate my book to the founders of the Contact in the Desert conference. So I'm going back there in the beginning of end of May, May 29th to June 1st, 2026. Contact in the Desert in Indio, outside of Palm Springs. Go there. It's the best UFO conference, I think, in the world. We have like 4,000 to 5,000 people who are all – there in community, discussing new ideas, discussing the latest revelations, discussing people's experiences. The whole experiences forum there, where about 40 people get into a room and they share their experiences. And if you go to that, I hope you do, David, you can start to discern really who's really on the edge and who's over the edge. That's what I call it. So I say, and I'm doing the Suzanne's conference again in San Diego, San Diego Transcendence Retreats.
Glastonbury.
Glastonbury. Yes. I'm doing Glastonbury, the Portal to Ascension.
Portal to Ascension.
Glastonbury retreat at the end of August. That should be a lot of fun. I think I might do a little speaking tour around Europe. I might go to Mallorca there. You can check it all on my website and email me if you want, have any questions. If you want to take my next remote viewing class, I think it'll be sometime in the fall. Email newrealities@earthlink.net. So it keeps snowballing. I'm writing another book about UFOs and the whole what it really means to be in contact, how that really changes us. I kind of hit on it a little bit, but what does it really mean to have these beings interfacing with humans? How does that change us? That's really exciting for me. I'd be writing.
When will that book come out?
Probably not till after they arrive in 2027.
All right. No. Autograph copies. By Bashar. Bashar will be autographing the copies of...
I'll be autographing copies. No,
of course. Of course.
You know, as far as that question again, we have to see the future. You know, I think it was George Bush who said the future will be better tomorrow. It's always changing. You know, it's kind of so maybe I think the future is always more than we can imagine. That's why it is the future, because if you can imagine, it's the past. So we're moving into a new time, and I think the ETs will be part of it for sure. And I'll be there right there with the welcoming party when they land.
I love it. I love it. Alan, it is so fun to hear you share your thoughts, your memories. You have spent so much time processing all of this and connecting with people who are thinking on the edge and also over the edge. And so I just love being at events where you are creating, you create energy wherever you go, and people love you. You are loved. So thank you for what you do.
I love people. That's why I think people are people too. No, I love people. It's my Aquarian nature. And we're really in this because of the community. Yeah, there are way out subjects and new ideas, but the people on this journey together in our maybe called evolutionary community are really good people for the most part. Don't you think so, David?
Absolutely. Yeah, I have had so much fun getting to know you over events that we've been at and also today. So, Alan, thanks for being with us, man. Appreciate it.
Really intelligent questions. I appreciate that. And challenging. I have to dig into myself. So I really like this interview. Thanks, David.
Hey friends, Dave Trotter here with Awaken Magazine. Before we dive into this episode, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our podcast. So if you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Amazon Music, click subscribe. Every platform's just a little bit different, but this will ensure that you get every single episode delivered right to your phone. And if you have just an extra minute, rate and review the show. That is a quick way to help us spread the word and help more people discover the incredible interviews that we release each and every week. All right, let's dive into this episode.